There are also very specific fears that people have that are very specifically related to their own childhood. And I'd like to give an example. A mom with twins had a kidnapping fear. She was afraid every time she saw a car drive by her house that her twins would be kidnapped. Now, this mother was adopted when she was a newborn, herself was adopted when she was a newborn, but her adoption did not become final till she was 1 year old, and her twins were approaching 1 year. So I was struck by the anniversary happening of her fear of kidnapping. And when I asked her who she thought was driving the car that drove by her house, she blurted out, "My biological mother." Adoption was never an issue for me. I have the best parents, she said. But her fears about her babies being kidnapped were rooted in her own guilty feelings. She said, "I get to keep my biological babies, and my biological mother did not. I can have biological babies, and my adoptive mother could not." Carrie's fantasy that her biological mother was threatening to kidnap her babies represented both her fears of retaliation for her aggressive victories over both her biological mother and her adoptive mother, and a repair of her disavowed feeling of loss by a reunion with her biological mother. This meaning of the memory, this understanding of the memory, resolved her kidnapping fear. It dissolved.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Eileen Lefcourt. Eileen Lefcourt has been the director and leader of the mother, baby, toddler groups and provided developmental consultation to parents for over 35 years. She has seen over 1,000 families and taught child psychiatry residents and parent-infant psychotherapy trainees. She has been on a faculty member of the Columbia Psychoanalytic Center since 1995. And our conversation today revolves around her recent book entitled When Mothers Talk, Magical Moments and Everyday Challenges from Birth to 3 Years. And the key phrase there is everyday challenges. These are not psychotherapy patients or analytic patients. These are people from the community, mothers who come together with their toddlers and infants and discuss the challenges that they face every day. And what Eileen has learned and reported in this book is about how central and useful it is to recognize the presence of mothers' memories of their own childhoods in how they perceive and interact with their children. Now, to those of us in the analytic world, this isn't surprising. We're quite familiar with how the past lives in the present. What's so valuable about this work is that this is not in a setting, as I say, of clinical work, but of parents speaking together. And we cover all kinds of everyday areas of weaning and sleeping and how infants get along with each other and naming body parts and autonomy versus independence, all the kinds of struggles that every parent goes through. And she brings her clinical wisdom and the group wisdom to helping them understand this. As I mentioned, she's in private practice in New York City, and her upcoming book is called Mothers and Daughters, The First 3 Years. I learned a great deal. I enjoyed her book immensely, and I hope you find this as fascinating as I did. Here's my conversation with Eileen Lefcourt. Eileen, welcome to the podcast. So good to have you.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
There are many advice books available for new parents about how one should engage with one's infant and toddler. And few of these books provide insights into the affective life of these new human beings. And even fewer of these books help us understand the essential role, and this is a key point that we're going to discuss today, the essential role that a mother's own memories from her own childhood play in how she experiences her young children. Your work for 35 years running a group setting that we will talk about, and your book teaches us how understanding the ways that the past lives in the present, or as Selma Freiberg characterized it, as ghosts in the nursery, how that understanding can provide relief for pressing distortions that are living in present day. But there's something else that I learned, and that I think that many readers of your book will learn about your work, and that is there seems to be something about the setting in which you operated it, which is a group setting of young mothers together among themselves and with their infants and toddlers that allows interventions and insights to be much more readily received and processed than one ordinarily expects that to be the case in the clinical setting. Many clinicians will read your book and will ask, as I asked you, that's amazing how quickly the patient or the individual received that awareness and how it seemed to impact their relationship with the child. And you said that these quotes are literally true, and we will get to them as we go through the book. To start us off, I'd like to read from page 1. And you write, "A mother's childhood memories hold some of the answers to the questions and concerns that typically arise with babies and toddlers and the decisions that need to be made. Mother's memories also contain the building blocks to create moments of shared delight that can nurture development. Memories can enable mothers to experience the enchantment of early childhood and the deep satisfactions of motherhood. The idea of magical moments captures the feeling that something extraordinary is happening. Love, with all its complexities, is its essence." And you go on to say, "The challenge for mothers is to understand the complexity of their own childhood memories and to help their babies and toddlers adapt to the everyday ups and downs of life, as well as to the exceptional ones." Eileen, start us off.
First of all, the things that we will talk about apply to fathers also, not just to mothers. In my groups, the groups are for mothers. When Anna Freud was looking for a job as a nanny, a prospective employer asked her, "What qualifies you to be a nanny? You've never had a job before. You've never studied anything about children." And she said, "I was once a child." The best qualification for being a mother or a parent, a father, is the fact of having been a child. And we will talk a lot about childhood memories. In your introduction, you said something about distortions. I don't think of a mother or a father's view of a child or reaction as a distortion. It's part of their relationship. It's real.
I stand corrected. Thank you. Do you want to read us from an example, just to start us off, with Cliff?
Okay. I do want to say childhood memories are like dreams in many ways. And they do have hidden messages. And we're going to discover some of the hidden messages that the mothers discover as we hear about their childhood memories. Mm-hmm. I also want to say, you mentioned Selma Freiberg, and she talked about ghosts in the nursery, very disturbing ghosts, ghosts that were dangerous. We're going to be talking about everyday ghosts. All parents, all adults have experiences in their past that get reactivated in the moment. And that's what we'll be talking about, like with Cliff. So I'm going to read from the book now. The book, When Mothers Talk. Cliff was a thriving 30-month-old little boy in a mother-toddler group. For the past 3 weeks, he had awakened happy every morning in his mother and father's bed. Every morning, his mother, Sally, was surprised. She insisted, "I definitely want Cliff to stay in his own bed, but there's nothing I can do about it. I sleep through it." Sally believed that sleeping through it was happening to her, and she could not control it. She felt helpless. The following question that created a connection between a childhood memory and her current interactions with Cliff was the first step towards control. I asked her, "Who slept through what when you were a little girl?" Sally's memory immediately came to mind. "Every night I had nightmares about our house burning down. I was terrified. I would sneak to my parents' bedroom and sleep on the floor outside their closed door. I didn't want to wake my mother. She slept through it every night."
Now, can you help us flesh this out? It's a wonderful example of the past living in the present. And when you engage Cliff's mother around this, what was her reaction to it? How did she think about it? How did it change things?
Well, I asked her, I wondered with her together about the connection between her memory and what was happening with Cliff. And I highlighted for her the similarities and differences. I said to her, "The current situation with Cliff is similar to your memory, but there are differences. You're now the parent sleeping through your child's distress rather than the scared child sleeping alone on the floor. And Cliff is a scared child getting something that you didn't get. Despite this, like you, Cliff's distress is not being addressed directly." Sally looked stunned with the repetition of her memory in the present. She recognized that in some ways Cliff was alone with his distress, the same as she had been, and she wanted to comfort him. And this is the magical part that we mentioned.
Yeah.
The following week, Sally told us in the group, "I don't know how it happened, but I started to hear Cliff when he got into our bed in the middle of the night."
It is magical, and it's wonderful. We could spend a great deal of time on this, but I want to capture more that the book provides, including many examples. And the next one that comes to my mind is something that you called memory narratives. That is co-creating shared memory narratives. And there's just this couple of sentences you write about that really captured my heart. You wrote, "1-year-old Todd had gone to a petting zoo and got scared when a goat bleated. When Todd's mother was telling Todd's father about what happened, Todd's mother asked, 'Todd, do you remember when you petted the goat and he bleated so loud? You got scared and cried. How loud did the goat bleat?' Turning passive to active and scared into safe, Todd initiated the goat's loud bleat." Bah. And it's a wonderful example of creating a shared memory, but I want to add something to it. There is this issue of where our fathers, I'm sort of representing the father side of things, and they're not absent in the book. They're just not emphasized because the group was of mothers. But in a number of occasions, this being one of them, Todd's mother is telling Todd's father in Todd's presence the story. So there is the third. There is the story being related to the father, and he is performing now the loud bleat for the father, which, in addition to turning passive to active, is an additional aspect of development that you do capture in the book and is worth noting.
Yeah. I want to highlight that babies do remember. Some people believe babies don't remember, and some people try to convince parents that the baby or the toddler won't remember, but there is evidence they do remember. So the question for us, for parents, is how is the child going to remember what happened? Are they going to remember it with a narrative, something shared with parents, mommy and daddy, or mommy and mommy, daddy and daddy? Or are they going to remember it by reliving the feelings of terror or rage? And there's an opportunity to help children remember with a narrative.
And as you point out frequently in the book, there are the words of the narrative, but also there is the affect of the narrative. There is the mother, and in this case, father's interest in understanding what happened, and the gentle, empathic way that, in this case, the mother is tuning into the child's experience. And you make the point that that rhythm of relatedness, that empathic attunement that the child is fortunately receiving, is what he or she will remember. And often we know that there are somatic memories, that the body remembers, the spirit remembers, and certainly the soul remembers. Let me give you another example, again, about memories. You write, Gemma described Marco. He is a very happy baby. He's especially happy playing with his dad. I was watching them yesterday. All of a sudden, Marco's face lit up with a big smile, and I remembered one time when my father was giving my twin brother a piggyback ride, and my stomach hurt so badly. They always had so much fun together, and I just realized that when my husband is playing with Marco, I often ask him to walk the dog. It's as if I want them to stop playing. What I wanted was my father to stop playing with my brother. Now I want Marco to have fun with his dad. Again, that's quite an insight for someone to have. Can you tell us more about it?
Well, a mother's description of her child is a mingling of what she sees and her thoughts and feelings about what she sees. So she's primed for hearing, either to herself or if I say something about it, what her reaction means, all the things that went into her reaction.
Okay. Yeah, that captures it. Sure. Now, unlike that example, there are some unrecognized childhood memories. And you give an example of that when you write, some mother-baby and mother-toddler interactions are repetitions of a mother's childhood memory. However, what is being repeated may be disguised or hidden. When a mother-child interactions are perplexing or stressful, they may be linked to an unrecognized childhood memory. Deidre frequently said things that she thought were mean to her 16-month-old daughter, Mandy, and she did not know why she kept doing it. Quote, the mean words just spill out of my mouth. My mother says very mean things to me. She always has. I hate it. I don't know why I keep doing it to Mandy. And you say, identifying specific childhood memories of pushing her mother away and linking them to her current interactions with Mandy helped Deidre to recognize that talking mean was a way to feel close to her own mother. I'll repeat that. That talking mean was a way to feel close to her own mother. She said, lately I've been pushing my mother away. I want to feel close to her, even though I'm so angry at her. Maybe talking mean to Mandy is a way to feel close to my mother while I push her away. This insight helped Deidre to be the kind of mother she wanted to be, not a mean mother. So it's not just magical moments and enchantment moments. It's also moments of nastiness and harshness. Yes?
Yes. And pain. Painful memories. When we had spoken earlier, you asked, well, how did Deidre's insight, that does seem magical, how was it influenced by being in a group, by her relationship with the other mothers in the group, which I do think does contribute to the speed with which and the impact of the insights in the group. During the early months and years of motherhood, with all its pleasures and stresses, feeling the loss of early nurturing from one's own mother or wished-for mother may be activated and contribute to the loneliness and isolation typically felt by mothers. And that's why they so often turn to relationships with other mothers. And that's why they come to a group.
It's a perfect segue, because the book then shifts to addressing different age groups, beginning with birth to 6 months, 6 to 12 months, 12 to 18, et cetera. And we're going to take little snippets from each of those age groups just to give a sample of how you approach various challenges in the different age groups. And the first thing you mention in 0 to 6 months is the importance of friendships among new mothers. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, yes. I think what gets activated for the mother are memories of her own early experience with her mother, or wished for mother, the nurturing, the support, the acceptance. And that is what mothers get from their, what I call, mommy friends. And I call them mommy friends to try to trigger the reader's memories of their mommy or their mom. And the term is often used.
So there's a category you're calling mommy friends, where mothers sort of, if they're not in a group like you've been leading, they just have such a commonality with other mothers, and they can share things that only other mothers would really understand. That is what brings them together.
An example in the book is a woman who is up in the middle of the night with her infant and notices out the window a light across the street and feels, I'm not alone. There is another mother up with her baby across the street.
Now, something that all mothers and fathers, of course, too, but most often you hear it from mothers, and that are typical mother fears. And let me read a section that addresses that. In reading this, I want to mention to the listener that throughout the book, you have questions to stimulate the reader's thoughts. For example, in this section I'm about to read, you write, what frightening thoughts about your baby have you had? And then you answer by saying the following. During the first 6 months of their baby's life, mothers may have nightmares about their babies or daytime fears of bad things happening to them. Lorraine, the mother of a three-month-old, announced during a mother's group that every time she walked past a door while holding a baby, she thought about the possibility of his head banging against the doorframe. Nikki then reported that every time she closed the car door, she imagined that she had slammed it on her baby's hand. These kinds of thoughts are frightening and typical for mothers with babies this age. In some ways, they increase mothers' vigilance to protect their babies. Frightening thoughts about hurting your baby may be triggered by your own childhood memories. Your own accident may not be remembered in the moment, but the feeling may have been awakened. In addition to powerful feelings of love and attachment and fierce motivation to protect their babies, mothers' feelings during the first 6 months may also include boredom, loneliness, guilt, anxiety, and anger. Mothers' frightening thoughts about their babies getting hurt or lost, the adaptive function of the thoughts, the memories that might trigger them, and the related feelings that intensify them are typical. The angry feelings that mothers have towards their babies can increase their fears and feelings of horror about their fears. As mothers discover how common the frightening thoughts are, and as their babies develop, these images and frightening thoughts usually diminish. We should pause for a moment and add a caveat that what this book and your work discusses is a mothering that's within the bell curve, as it were. You do not address postpartum depression or postpartum psychosis. Those are major difficulties and need a form of evaluation and treatment that isn't what's being covered, but should be mentioned as something I'm sure you're aware of and would make referral if you were faced with that. But typical fears, fill us in about that.
Well, I was going to add to the typical fears that you read about and the kind of feelings of guilt and boredom and anger can intensify reactions to those typical feelings. But there are also very specific fears that people have that are very specifically related to their own childhood. And I'd like to give an example. A mom with twins had a kidnapping fear. She was afraid every time she saw a car drive by her house that her twins would be kidnapped. Now, this mother was adopted when she was a newborn, herself was adopted when she was a newborn. But her adoption did not become final till she was 1 year old. And her twins were approaching 1 year. So I was struck by the anniversary happening of her fear of kidnapping. And when I asked her who she thought was driving the car that drove by her house, she blurted out, "My biological mother." Adoption was never an issue for me. I have the best parents, she said. But her fears about her babies being kidnapped were rooted in her own guilty feelings. She said, "I get to keep my biological babies, and my biological mother did not. I can have biological babies, and my adoptive mother could not." Carrie's fantasy that her biological mother was threatening to kidnap her babies represented both her fears of retaliation for her aggressive victories over both her biological mother and her adoptive mother, and a repair of her disavowed feeling of loss by a reunion with her biological mother. This meaning of the memory, this understanding of the memory, resolved her kidnapping fear. It dissolved.
There's another point that you made, perhaps without knowing it, but I want to underline it, that she shared with you her fear of the driver kidnapping her children, and you went into it. You didn't say, "Oh, that's silly," or "No, that's not going to happen," or "Rest assured, that's really just your imagination." You said, "Tell me more about it." You opened it up and
I confronted her. I said, "Who's driving the car?"
Well, it didn't sound like a confrontation as much as a curiosity. I'm returning your favor when you corrected my statement earlier about distortion. I'm giving you the benefit of what it sounded like to me, which is that you were really sharing your wish to understand.
I'm corrected by you now.
Okay, fair enough.
It's
right.
Confrontation. Yes, I was curious, and curiosity in this work, and for a parent with a child, is the main stance or position is curiosity.
And that's a lesson for all of us, parents, grandparents, and certainly clinicians. And in fact, it's a wonderful segue to the next piece that I outlined. I read your book and had all kinds of note takings and a great pleasure in doing so. And this is where you write about understanding each other. You write, "A mother and her baby are discovering what can be known about each other's inner worlds of thoughts and feelings. If your baby tries to grab the cookie you are eating and you give some to your baby, we can imagine that your baby feels understood by you. But what happens when you understand what your baby wants, but you are not going to give it to your baby?" This is the sentence that caught my attention. "Being understood when a wish is not gratified can make it easier for a baby to manage the frustration and angry feelings that are evoked." I'm going to read that again. "Being understood when a wish is not gratified can make it easier for a baby, not to mention for an adult, for an adolescent, for everybody, make it easier for all of us to manage the frustration and angry feelings that are evoked." You then go give an example of 10-month-old Serena, while sitting on her mother's lap, tried to grab her mother's coffee cup. Her mother moved the cup out of reach and said, "No." Serena screamed. Her mother said, "I know you want my cup. You sound angry. Here is your cup." While Serena may not have understood all of her mother's words, she felt her mother's empathy for her frustration and anger. Serena accepted the substitute her mother offered. It's a great example.
Yes, babies do not need to understand, or toddlers, all the words in order to feel understood. They also respond to the feelings and learn the words. And importantly, they are learning that we can think about feelings. We can think about thoughts, and they can be known by someone else, what's now called reflective functioning. And that is a big part of the mother-baby, mother-toddler interactions that I'm describing throughout the book.
Mm-hmm. Now, there would not be a book on the first 3 years of life that didn't have important sections on sleep, the concern of all new parents. You write, Esther was 9 months and was waking every 3 hours. Her mother, Adriana, was unaware that her checking on Esther, tiptoeing into her room throughout the night, was waking her. She was also unaware that her checking was related to childhood memories. When Adriana was 5 years old, her mother had had a stillbirth. Adriana realized that her memories of what she was told throughout her life and her mother's ongoing depression and anxiety were triggering her own night waking and checking on Esther. With this insight, Adriana resolved the sleep problem. Mothers who have experienced the death of a parent or sibling or other significant loss or separation may have interactions with their babies that affect sleep patterns. Mothers' memories of nightmares can also have an impact. Both everyday experiences and more significant life events influence baby sleep patterns. Innate traits, of course, may also play a role. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, Esther realized that her current anxiety was rooted in her past experiences. In terms of sleep that you mentioned, there are two complex developmental milestones that are often called training. Sleep training and toilet training. Now, toilet training has existed for a long time. Sleep training isn't a new idea, but these are mutually regulated patterns.
By mutually regulated, you mean what?
Between mother and child.
Okay.
They have to do with the interaction. You may be able to train a dog to sit that has no psychology to it, but sleep and toilet, learning to use the potty, do. And I highlight that throughout the book, what those mutual regulations are about. For the older children, sometimes having mommy choices and toddler choices can be useful. So a mother can set a bedtime, and it can mean no more toys, but the toddler does the falling asleep. It's a self-regulated part of a mutually regulated interaction.
Well, that's, as you say, that's an essential theme of your work and your book, which is that it may be just about what the child does, but it is also being influenced by not only who the mother is, but the mother's memories or unconscious past is also playing a role in the interaction. Well, that is certainly the case when it applies to a section you have identifying body parts. Do you want to read for us?
Yes. In a lively discussion about the words for genitals that mothers choose, Marina said, Ariel is only 11 months. I know many mothers from the beginning teach their daughters the word vagina, even though they're not really talking about the vagina. I don't know what words to teach Ariel, but I think it's important. What she is touching is her vulva. It's a part of her body that she's noticed, but I don't feel comfortable saying that word. Vulva seems too sexy. Labia feels too medical. Vagina is incorrect. No word feels right. I want Ariel to feel comfortable with all parts of her body. I don't talk about her anus, but that's different. I'm amazed that I'm talking about this at all. I just want to highlight the setting. This is in a mother's group, and this woman is talking about things she didn't talk about before or think about before. These were only her private parts or
right.
Down there.
Right. Down there, yeah. Uh-huh.
Jenna had different reactions to interactions with Stefan about his body. She told the mother's group that her milk letdown reflex during breastfeeding was strong and pleasurable. She was happy to see Stefan touching his penis during diaper changes and baths, and was teaching him the word penis. She had resumed sex with her husband after the recommended 6-week abstinence following delivery and was delighted that her milk spraying letdown reflex was triggered when she had an orgasm. Jenna's boastful declarations during the mother's group triggered some envy, some embarrassment, some ridicule, and some inspiration. Marina said, I think I'll start to say vagina, like most moms.
Now, you say in the group It elicited ridicule, inspiration, embarrassment. What was that like?
It was understandable.
Yeah. Where did the ridicule come from?
That she was talking about private things in a public setting.
Huh.
Some people thought this was a little too much. Marina was struggling to find body words to teach Ariel until Ariel was born. As I said, she talked about down there and private parts, but she wanted to change. There's an expanding sense of self that happens when you have a baby, and this is part of it. I'm reminded of a mother who said that her mother used the word tickly to refer to her genitals, and she liked it and wanted to use the word tickly with her daughter because it included good feelings. So she decided to name her daughter's genitals tickly vagina.
Mm-hmm. So it also connected her with her past, which was apparently a pleasurable connection.
Yes.
The next thing I want to go to, and we're in the 6 to 12 month section of the book, and that's about how you help babies and soon-to-be toddlers interact with each other. It's a very interesting thing when one sees it or hears it from others. You write, "Mothers may disagree about when babies need social help. When Chester grabbed a book away from Abby and she cried, Chester's mother, Myra, intervened to describe what happened and to help him give the book back. You like to play with Abby. There's no grabbing. You need to give the book back to Abby. On the other hand, Abby's mother thought adult help was unnecessary. Abby can defend herself. I want her to grab it back. You say that there are different opinions about when adult intervention is useful to resolve baby and toddler conflicts with each other. Some mothers and professionals believe that as long as they're not hurting each other, let them work it out. They will learn from the interaction. Others believe that adults can help teach standards of behavior and model ways to resolve conflict. And in some ways, both ideas apply. The challenge is to decide which is more useful in which specific situation with each child and with each mother. Childhood memories may influence decisions." And you go on to say, "Joanna had a vivid, painful memories of being bullied as a child and was angry that her mother, counselors at camp, and teachers at school allowed it to happen. Marin had many guilty memories about aggressively teasing her younger sister, bunkmates, and classmates. For both mothers, understanding their own childhood memories that were reactivating intense feelings of guilt and anger and impulses to retaliate or withdraw helped them each decide when and what kind of adult intervention would be most helpful to their babies." That is, among the many other things we're discussing, that is a very common challenge that one sees in life and also hears in the office as clinicians.
So Joanna frequently jumped in to rescue her daughter from what she experienced as bullying, though others did not think of it as bullying, a reference back to your comment about distortion. And Marin's guilt about bullying often prevented her from helping her daughter when it seemed to be needed, as they each understood the impact of their childhood memories on their current behavior, they were better able to help their child in the moment. I'm reminded of another kind of example. Jasmine was 10 months old and had a 3 year older brother who frequently grabbed from her. And when she joined the group, Jasmine started grabbing toys from all the other babies. And the mother had thought her toys being grabbed at home by her brother was no big deal because she didn't mind. She loved her brother's attention and she just found another toy to play with. But when she saw Jasmine grab from others, she thought, well, maybe she doesn't like it that much. And maybe I should let her know it's not okay that her brother keeps grabbing from her, which she changed her response at home and said, there's no grabbing. She's busy playing with that. And Jasmine stopped grabbing from the other babies.
This group that you're describing sounds fascinating.
Well, they were very successful for many years.
Yeah, that's nice. Attachment and autonomy. A brief comment on that. You begin or you intersperse with a question that you ask, When are you aware of having conflicted feelings about your toddler's autonomy? And then you write, while toddlers are motivated by both attachment needs and autonomy, autonomous strivings, and the tensions between them, mothers of toddlers are motivated to both support their toddler's autonomous explorations and to keep them close. Sometimes these aims are in conflict. Sometimes a toddler's autonomy clashes with a mother's need for closeness. Wendy described, quote, I keep saying I want Mia to play with the other children, but whenever she's on my lap touching base, I keep caressing her. Maybe I'm keeping her too close. What a lovely self-observation.
Yes. And Wendy's insight enabled her to respond to Mia with a momentary hug when she touched base, secure base, but to not keep caressing her, which was preventing Mia from returning to play. Wendy and Mia had different temperaments. Her mother described them as, I'm very shy. I feel very comfortable when Mia is on my lap in the mother's group. Mia is very outgoing. When mother-child temperaments clash or when they're aligned is something that comes up a lot in the group temperament.
Speaking of things that come up in the group and otherwise, the topic of parents wish to have a boy or a girl. It is a powerful and often conflicted topic. Why don't you share with us some of the things that you learned from the group on this topic?
Okay, I will preface the section I'm going to read with, while as you say, the wish can be strong, the actual baby once born can also be very strong. And those wishes before the birth change once the baby is born.
Ideally. Well, maybe we're dealing with different populations, but let me not interrupt that. But why don't you start by reading, then we can talk about it.
Feelings continue, but they are also influenced by the positive relationship that then develops with the baby in most situations. Okay, this is from the book. A mother's reactions to learning the sex of her baby may include the fulfillment of a wish, a disappointment, or an entanglement of feelings that can neutralize a prior preference for the sex of her baby. That's the comment. In other words, in response to her actual baby, a mother's wish for a baby can fade and her actual baby can be claimed as my baby. Sloane's yearnings for a daughter intensified when she gave birth to her third son. She brought a photo of her 17-month-old third son wearing a dress with blonde curls almost to his shoulders. Sorry, this was her middle son. The baby was in the group. With blonde curls almost to his shoulders, to show to the mother baby group. Her words conveyed both her wish and her grief. He would make such a pretty girl. We were able to begin to talk about Sloane's grieving for the daughter that she would never have and her pleasure in the photo as a pretend realization of her longtime wish to have a daughter. Sloane became able to differentiate her wishes to have a daughter from her deep love and profound pleasures with her sons. In a dramatic gesture, communicating the complexity of her feelings and conflicting impulses, Sloane tore up the photo and demonstrated that her actual sons were more valued than her wished for daughter. She decided it's time for his first haircut. Now, the group discussion with this is not written, I'm talking now. Group discussion with my guidance shifted from Sloane's pleasures and excitements in the photograph of her son, which the group got very involved in sharing the excitement. It shifted to Sloane's pleasures with her two older sons. I asked her questions about her sons, what she liked about them, what they did, what they liked to play with, what were the masculine things they did. And so her pleasure in her sons got more activated in the moment in the group.
You facilitated her mourning of her wish, yeah?
And then she tore up the photograph. And we could ask, well, did Sloane rip up the photograph to please me? Or did something change in her from our interaction? I don't know for sure. She was not in analysis.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But my belief is something changed for her.
And this segues into the piece you have about toddlers being proud to show their naked bodies. You laugh. You want to read that section, or should I read it?
Well, I laugh. I'm interested, curious in the things that you've chosen to read from the book.
Right.
That was the laugh.
Well, hold on. You can't just leave it there. Tell me more. What did you imagine about my choices? Well, you can say it. No one's listening, Eileen.
I'm curious about all your choices.
Yeah, sure.
Uh-huh. The Todd bleeding at the goat, the scared little boy, and the genital difference, you know, the ones you've chosen.
Sure.
It's a way to get to know you, what stood out to you.
And it should be noted, and I actually did a sampling, that there are many, many more things in the book than we will get to. You go into toilet training, you talk about telling the truth or lying, parents fighting in front of children, sharing feelings with children, apologizing, playing with peers. There's a whole series of things that we didn't get to that I mentioned both to flesh out the book and also to whet the appetite of the potential reader of the book.
Okay. Discovery of the male-female genital difference is thought to occur around 16 months and can influence reactions to seeing parents naked as well as to seeing other children naked. For example, Davina had bathed with her mother since she was a baby and seemed to have had no reaction to seeing her mother naked. When she was about 17 months, she began to try to touch her mother's pubic hair. Awareness of male-female genital differences and child-adult genital differences can also influence children's interest in their own genitals. Philip had always bathed with his older sister. It was convenient and they had fun. After he turned 16 months, Philip began to hold his penis whenever he and his sister were naked together. This change in his behavior may have been a reaction to a new awareness of the male-female genital difference and its meaning to him. His mother, Arizona, decided to bathe them separately. Trish, another group mother, confronted her. Isn't it better for him to learn about boy-girl differences? Arizona said, yes, it's important to learn about them in a way that's comfortable, not in a way that makes him so nervous. Claude added, Ellie acts as if she doesn't notice. Maybe that's her reaction to noticing.
Again, a very astute comment. She acts as if she doesn't notice. Maybe that's her reaction to noticing. That's the kind of comment an analyst might think about or an analyst Anne might think about. And here it comes up in a group setting. It's really quite lovely.
But it also comes up in an ongoing group. Groups meet for 30 weeks. The women enroll in the group for the year, academic year, which is 30 weeks. So they also, in a sense, are learning what's of interest and what might be important. So that's part of what generates the topics that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You go on to write about toddlers are proud to show. You see that?
I do want to say another mom in that group. Well, no, sorry, Claude. She talked about tuning out her seeing her brothers naked, and her daughter was tuning out. She thought maybe tuning out her. So it goes back again to the mother's memories. Toddlers are proud to show their naked bodies and to have them admired. They may enjoy total abandon being naked. There are innate and acquired individual differences in their body explorations and how much and what kind of genital pleasure each toddler seeks. A toddler's body excitement can be contagious or barely noticed. Toddlers may be curious about each part of their genitals, how they look, smell, and feel. During a mother's group, Eliana described Louisa's discovery at 18 months. Louisa's older brother was taking a bath, and she was sitting on the floor naked with her legs spread, exploring with her fingers. I was so surprised when, pointing to her clitoris, she said, "This is my little penis." I was happy about, this is the mom talking, I was happy about her discovery and told her that that's her clitoris. I wanted her to know it's great to have a clitoris. She said, "No, mommy, that's my little penis." It seemed important to her in the moment to think about it that way. I don't know why, but I stop myself from insisting it's her clitoris. This is a very important, I think, comment that the mom was making. She was making a distinction between their minds, what was important in the mom's mind and what was important in her little girl's mind. Further discussion highlighted that Louise's brother was 4 years older and everything about him was bigger. And while it was important to her mother that Louisa learn the word clitoris and not compare her clitoris in a diminished way to a penis, she believed Louisa's statement had different meaning to her daughter than to her. She was confident that her daughter valued her clitoris. There's no doubt in that.
And no doubt, given how attuned and empathic her mother is to who the daughter is at that moment, that she would grow to be someone who would value her own femininity in a lovely way.
And there was space between them for their separateness of minds, even about something that was so important to the mother.
There's so much more that we could cover. Let me just ask you to tell a story that you have about weaning. That's another topic one often hears a great deal about. People wean at 4 months, 14 months, or 4 years. You hear all kinds of stories. Tell us what you've learned in the group from about weaning.
Are you going to read about...
Or you could just summarize it, the example of Naomi.
Well, a mom was very conflicted. Her toddler was 17 months, and she very much enjoyed the breastfeeding. In her own history, she had had a severe accident as a little girl. Her mother spilled coffee and scalded her face and shoulders and body, which was scarred for many years, but eventually all the scars were recovered. And as she said, worse than the scalding of her body was her mother yelling at her all the time, which made her body burn, in a sense. And she felt that while she was breastfeeding, she was giving Wally all the love, security, protection, and safety that he needed. And she was very conflicted about weaning him. When she described her conflict, I asked her, and described how wonderful the breastfeeding was, I asked her, what do you think about while you're breastfeeding? And she said, oh, I think about a lot of things, about calls I need to make. I text sometimes. He's very comfortable and happy. I think about lots of other things. I said, so while you are while you're breastfeeding, you get a little break from being with him. And she saw it as an escape from him, time to not be with him. This insight about how the only time she got away from Wally was while she was breastfeeding helped her resolve her conflict. And she decided to begin to very gradually wean him.
Eileen, there's so much more I would like to both learn myself and also share with the listeners. Our time is limited. Let me just ask you, though, before we have to say goodbye, another topic that's on everybody's mind today is screen time. Share your thoughts about screen time.
I think with every new technology, there's concern about what impact the technology will have on adults and certainly on children. Television, comic books, every new technology, there is concern. It might be of interest that when the printing press was first developed, people were afraid that if all the information was in books, it would ruin our memories. We wouldn't need to remember anything. So I think there's been a lot of really hysteria about screen time. And the question is, how will screen time be integrated into adults' lives as well as into the children? Too much we know is no good. None at all, you're out of the present day and there are things to be gained from it. So I think it's about finding the right balance for children at different ages. Reading is great for children. If we read to them exclusively and didn't play with them, they'd be missing out on a lot. If we never read to them, that would be a problem. So if we look at the extremes, it's clear. Finding what's the right balance is more complicated.
And we should specify that when we say screen time, everything you just said applies to infants and toddlers being on a screen or not. Then there's interactive screens and passive screens and that whole conversation. But there's also the issue of parents being on screens. I think we have all experienced ourselves and witnessed others, parents, pushing children on swings while looking on their phones. And I can tell you, as someone who witnesses that, it's a very disturbing thing to see. I can't speak to what's happening inside the two individuals, but inside myself, it's unsettling.
Yeah. But of course, children, babies, toddlers lose their parents' attention in many moments, many different moments. And whether it's talking to a friend while you're pushing your baby on the screen or off in La La Land. So it's how babies, toddlers, and parents come back together. And in what context are they losing mommy's attention for a while?
I had a feeling you were going to soften my extreme reaction. And you did. Thank you. No, it was perfectly good. Before we go, tell us a bit about your background, your training. How did you come to do this and learn all the things you've learned?
Well, I was very interested in babies as a little girl. And when I was 10 years old, my neighbor had a baby. And I learned a lot from the nurse, the baby nurse, about babies. But she wanted to teach me how to prop the bottle for the baby. I don't even know if people nowadays know what propping the bottle is, but it's literally the baby's in her crib and the bottle is on a blanket propped in the baby's mouth. And I thought there was something wrong with that, that the baby needed more than just the milk. As a teenager, I started reading Freud, and then I started reading Bowlby and Winnicott and then Selma Freiberg. And Ghosts in the Nursery really grabbed my attention. And where her ghosts were dangerous ghosts, but she does say, Selma Freiberg did say, there are ghosts in every nursery. And I was interested in the ghosts in the nurseries where there's no funding or programs available for parents to really address the everyday ghosts that they're dealing with. The ghosts in analysis that come into analysis. So actually with the support of Ethel Person to be on my first board when I opened my center, I started a program where I could do this. She said, you're ready to do it, open your center, run your mother's groups, and I did. And about 7 years later, I applied as an affiliate scholar to Columbia and was there in training for 5 years for the application of psychoanalysis to parent-infant work, and then joined their faculty and helped to establish the parent-infant program at Columbia.
Well, it is to the parents' benefit and to all of us listening to you. And the book is called When Mothers Talk, Magical Moments and Everyday Challenges from Birth to 3 Years. Eileen, thank you for your work. Thank you for our back and forth correcting each other and finding a place of curiosity together, which enriches us all. It's been a pleasure.
And thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.